Families. It's all about family, isn't it? And our love for them. And this little series of just the second message that we've been having on family. There'll be several more that will come. I don't know for sure just how many. It'll depend on where we get, how far we get, and so forth. Last Sunday night, we started our series with the idea of fighting for our families. And I think we all would agree that it is a fight. Anybody that thinks that we can raise a family for God in this day and age without battling against the forces that would destroy our families, that would bring disintegration to our marriages and destroy our families, is really naive. And so we talked last Sunday night about the idea of just a couple of things. You know, as many books have been written about marriage and family, thousands and thousands of books, one couldn't begin to cover in a comprehensive manner all of the things that need to be said and could be said about family. But last Sunday night, we just majored on the aspect of one of the things we don't want to be is passive parents. Passive parenting. If we're passive parenting, then we won't be alert to the monster of technology that is taking over our children and teenagers' lives in this day and age in which we live. That this monster of technology, cell phones, iPads, television sets, computers, all of those things can be used for good and have certainly a good purpose. But what's happening is that many, many times, as parents, we are not policing. We are not being aware that our children are being introduced to technology and sometimes are far ahead of us when it comes to the understanding of technology than we older ones are. And how wise we need to be in limiting that. Some parents are giving their children cell phones now in the first, second, and third grade. And one of the Christian psychologists that I read over, and we shared this last Sunday night, one of the Christian psychologists, a very well-known one, said, he said, there should be no TV, iPad, cell phone, or whatever in the bedroom, the children's bedroom, period. He said, it's a rule. And then he made this statement, no child or teen should have unrestricted rights to privacy in their home. Sometimes kids in jest, other times in dead seriousness, will put up, this is my room, stay out, no admittance, and all of that. And his clear teaching was that as long as children are in your home, they should never reach a place or have a status of where that's their room, I don't go in there. If you don't do that, you are probably being real naive as to what is going on in there, because you may be overestimating your child's immunity to the things that appeal to the flesh. We also talked about a kind of a sensitive issue, but probably the monster of technology is introducing in our day and age an addiction that is greater even than drug addiction, and it is sexual addiction. Many, many children and teenagers are finding themselves addicted at an early age to X-rated stuff and become acquainted with it to degrees in their thinking and in their experience and observation that they never should have or never should be, because sexual addiction is the most common of all addictions, and it's fostered by technology. The reason for that, and if you'll remember, we stated almost every other addiction that people have, you require that you acquire a taste for that, like alcohol, for example. If you're going to be an alcoholic or if you become an alcoholic, that requires that you acquire a taste for alcohol. But sexual addiction does not require that, because we are all created sexual beings. And from the earliest days of our youth, and particularly in the school systems nowadays, we are being apprised of that fact. And so many, many teenagers nowadays are facing not just drug addiction, but sexual addiction. And perhaps we'll set aside a time, I'm not sure, at least I might put it in your notes some night before we're done with this series, that there's actually 10 Those who deal with this, psychologists and psychiatrists, have identified 10 different types of sexual addiction. That's pretty amazing if you think about it. As I was thinking and reading about that, it really stood out in my mind. So 70% of parents don't know what their kids are watching on their cell phone or on their iPads or on their notebooks. And then we had this rule for all of us. We had this suggestion for all of us, is that rules without relationship equals rebellion. Rules without relationship is almost certain to result in rebellion of our teenagers and of our children. Doesn't mean you won't have some rebellion even with relationship. I don't know that there's any home that I've ever known, even if they had a good relationship, where at times there wasn't some type of rebellion, even joined with relationship. But if you only have rules, I remember one time years ago, a young lady in our church, her mother, she had come to our youth group, and then her mother started coming and found the Lord. And her mother had grown up in apart from the things of God because she had rebelled in her early years against a puritanical background, a very legalistic background where everything was measured by how you dressed and how you looked. And she had rebelled against that and left the church, left the things of God. And she found the Lord, but then, even though she was coming to our church and didn't hear this kind of stuff, she reverted back to that standard of equating righteousness with rules and with an attitude of a puritanical no fun, no, just. And the teenage girls, this teenage daughter, she said to me when she came in for counsel, and she said, "Pastor Larry, I just regret the day that my mom found the Lord because she's turned into ugly nice." And I thought, what kind of a description is that? But then I understood it was a pharisaical, legalistic, all kinds of rules without relationship, and it was producing extreme rebellion in the daughter. And so we had quite some time about that. Also, one thing I don't know that I mentioned last Sunday night, parenting often involves getting help from others. I don't know that anyone at times... all of us as parents at times aren't ready to pull our hair out, if we're honest, when we're bringing our children up. I don't know what to do with this child. I don't know how to do that. And sometimes that's when it's wise to talk to godly parents who have weathered the storm, who have been through this, and get their ideas and their counsel on that as to what that is. And there's also a lot of good books that you can get out about that. And then one child said this, and I closed with last week's review with this statement then. One child who was being lectured by his mother for something that he did that she often did, which was speech. Lots of times you'll hear parents use speech that they'll censor their children for using that same kind of speech. And she said to her pastor, "I wish my mom and dad were not half Christians." And you see, when our children get that idea, teenagers or children, when they get that idea that we're half Christian, in other words, don't do as I say, and they see the inconsistency there, they lose respect for the things of God and for us as parents. So we left that there last Sunday night, and we're going to go on now and take a whole different emphasis tonight. And I've titled this tonight, "A Good Marriage or No." A good marriage or not, in other words. And as I told you last Sunday night about parenting, I would like to be able to do some things in the parenting role that I had over the years with my children who are now grown and have their own children. And in fact, we're even great-grandparents. So that's generations ago. There's some things I would do just like I did before, just like we always did. There's some things I would add or some things I would change because I see that they were not effective or that I was a passive parent and did not fulfill my role in that regard. But tonight now, I would also say that as we talk about a good marriage, I would like to tell you that I'm a perfect husband. I'd like to tell you that, but I'm afraid I would hear gales of laughter from the back row back there where my wife is seated, and she would, I asked my wife a while back, do you see a different guy in the pulpit teaching and preaching than what lives with you at home? And she said, no, you're the same goofy guy in both places. I felt better about that. There are no perfect husbands, and there are no perfect marriages. And so as I share these things tonight, I'm just sharing them out of a concern for all of us together. And those of you that might be here that have been married many years, I don't think we ever reach a place in marriage, no matter how many years we've been married, of where we can't evaluate our hearts and say, Lord, make me a better husband, make me a better wife. And those of you that are in your marriage, that are of younger years, of a younger generations, you can evaluate some of these things and say, that is an area that I can see that we certainly need to work on or to talk through or to work out, or that's a stalemate in our life. And if you're here as a person that's not even married, you can remember some of these things. I spoke with my granddaughter today, that we just were down in Denver to see one of my granddaughters, and I told her, I sent her the book, The Five Love Languages, because she's getting married in a year or so. Sent her that book by Gary Chapman. And by the way, as couples, you've heard me teach on that before in Sunday school here. If you don't have that book and you're not familiar with The Five Languages of Love, you ought to get that book. I've seen couples and read testimonials of couples that have been married for 25, 30, 35 years that would say, I wish we had known that when we first started out. It would have saved so much anger, so much frustration, so much grief if I had understood that we as spouses and husbands and wives have different languages of love. That's by Gary Chapman. You can get it off the Amazon. You can get it used even for about $5. But I said to her, when we were down there, I said, did you guys ever read that book? She said, oh, yes. We read every line in that book together. And she said, we discussed it. It was so helpful to us. Thank you. She calls me Gramps. She said, thank you, Gramps, for that. And then I said, now I've got another one for you by Gary Chapman. Things I Wish I Had Known Before We Got Married. That's the title of the book. And it's really a good book, Things I Wish I Had Known Before I Got Married. So you might give that if you have children or grandchildren. Get them the five languages of love and say, I just love you much. I want you to read this. It will help you in your relationship. Now, tonight we're talking about marriage, whether or not we have a sound marriage and what we can do about it, how we can just keep on course. Someone has said that marriage is like flies on a screen door. Those that are in, one out, and those that are out, one in. The question that I think about that, and I'm not sure that's true, but it might have more truth than what we would hope sometimes. But over the years, in the numbers of people that I have married, I have often seen, I don't ever remember a couple saying, we're going to get married and just be flat out miserable. That's our plan. That's our goal. We're just going to bite at one another. We're going to be snide. We're going to be rude to one another. We're going to avoid one another. We're just going to put one another down. We're just going to walk around and not talk with one another. We're just going to, that's our plan, Pastor. We're just going to get married and make life miserable for one another. I've never heard anyone say that. But in 55 years of ministry, I have sure seen that page turn out that manner of where so many marriages today are just like that. Now, if you've ever been on a jet plane for a very long flight, let's say you're flying from New York City to Sacramento, and you reached your destination without any problem, you may or may not have realized that if that jet plane had been off target by 1 degree on the way from New York to Sacramento, you would have not reached your destination. You would have been hundreds of miles from where you wanted to end up. I read also about some little birds today. They are amazing little creatures. They travel 7,100 miles without ever landing. Can you imagine that? that they can fly seven, they don't ever land. 7,000, they go from the Arctic to the Antarctic and somewhere else along on the other side there. But they travel that distance without ever landing to just a certain spot on a little beach. And that's where they nest every year. Can you imagine how God has put in their mind, in their little head, God has put a GPS, so to speak, a global positioning system that through clouds and through trackless ocean lands, that they can travel all of that and be right on course. I propose to us tonight as we talk about these things that these are just some things that will help us to stay focused on the end result. Are we on track? Are we enjoying the relationship that God intended us to have, or are we living in checkmate? Are we living in just a place of where there's we have our lighter moments, we have some times when things go well, but for most of the time, we just tolerate one another. Our marriage is not a mutual admiration society, it's a mutual toleration society. I hope that's not the case for anyone here tonight. But if it is, maybe some of these things will help us. You know, just about everything that we purchase today has any value that comes with it has with it a what's called an owner's manual. The owner's manual tells us what we need to know about the successful operation and maintenance of that which we have purchased with our hard-earned money. There's one in every automobile. If you get a furnace, there's an owner's manual with it. If you even go over here to the local hardware store, you'll get something there. It'll probably have an owner's manual with it that tells you what you should do and what you should not do. I have one with my steel chainsaw. And once in a while, I have to get that thing out and read it because it doesn't want to start. And I think, now I must not be doing something right because, by and large, it started pretty well up until now. What am I doing wrong? And I have to get that owner's manual out and go through that. Now, marriage is intended, of course, we know that we have an owner's manual for the institution of marriage, and that's the Word of God. So if you have your Bibles, let me just read to you quickly these verses, and we may not get all done tonight. I'm not going to rush, but we'll quit when it gets time to quit. And then we'll continue on. 2:18 of Genesis. Genesis 2:18. Well, first of all, verse 18, and then we'll go to 20 through 25. Then the Lord God said, "It's not good that man should be alone. I will make him a helper fit for him." And then it says, go down to verse 20. The man gave names, that's Adam, of course, to all livestock and to the birds of heaven and to every beast of the field. But for Adam, there was not found a helper fit for him. So the Lord caused a deep sleep to fall upon the man, and while he slept, took one of his ribs and closed up its place with flesh. And the rib that the Lord God had taken from the man, he made into a woman and brought her to the man. Then the man said, "This is at last bone of my bones and flesh of my flesh. She shall be called woman, because she was taken out of man. Therefore," we're all familiar with this verse now, "a man shall leave his father and mother and hold fast to his wife, and they shall become one flesh. And the man and his wife were both naked and were not ashamed." And then if you want to turn over to chapter 3, just two verses there. Then the man called his wife's name, 3:20, then the man called his wife's name Eve, because she was the mother of all living. And the Lord God made for Adam and for his wife garments of skin, and he clothed them. Now, right away in your notes, I'm just going to jump into this. People could say there's lots of reasons for marriage. One is companionship, and the other is creation and the sustaining, a creation and sustaining of the human race. But the ultimate foundation of marriage, the ultimate purpose of marriage, is to reveal God. That's God's ultimate purpose, is that He had a plan when He created man, and then with that man placed a woman. God's ultimate purpose was to reveal Himself in a unity and in an experience in a relationship that would make his plan look good, that would make God look good, so that God, in essence, could look down and see a husband and wife living together in harmony and unity and say, that's exactly what I had in mind, just exactly what I had in mind. And his smile would be upon that. And then when children came along and he saw that mom and dad raising them in the nurture and admonition of the Lord, he would say, that's exactly what I had in mind. They're doing just exactly the way I have outlined it and what I want them to do. Now, in order for that to happen, however, there has to be some things that take place. So we're going to jump right into that. The first one here is leave. Therefore, a man will leave father and mother. Now, we've heard this all before, but it's a good review for all of us, because you may be here and have children that are married. And so you listen up, especially if you're in this place. Therefore, a man will leave father and mother. And what that means is that marriage creates a sacred space where faithfulness can be demonstrated and where the loyalty in a marriage is now transferred from the mom and the dad, where these two individuals previously lived. That loyalty is now transferred from mother and father to the spouse that is married. And this loyalty is a very strong bond. And this couple creates this space, and they no longer look to mom or dad directly, notice that word, for guidance or for advice. If they do, it is the couple who initiates it and not the parents interjecting it. Are you listening to all of this? This is not just a geographical leaving, whether you live right next door to your parents after you are married or 1,000 miles away. This is not talking about geographical distance. This is talking about a psychological and emotional distance or independence. You know, there are people who leave in marriages. They leave geographically, but they don't leave psychologically. When I was reading about this, one woman called up her pastor on their honeymoon, and she said, I think this is going to be a long marriage. It don't take you very long sometimes to find out what you got into. She said, I think this is going to be a long marriage. She said, my husband has called his mom every day since we've been on our honeymoon. Now, I don't see that as a good sign. That might not be a sin. That might not be anything it's just an indication that there is a dependence there, that now he's going to have to learn to transfer that dependence upon mom back to his spouse or over to his spouse. Not that it's wrong for him to call his mom often, but when you're calling your mom every day or several times a day on your honeymoon, that's a harbinger that there's something missing somewhere. There's going to be some problems, I can tell you, in that relationship. Marriage has to do with a fundamental, a psychological commitment to leave father and mother. That doesn't mean that mom and dad are not involved in your life as friends and family, and that you don't honor them as parents. But from the moment a person is married, their loyalty is to their husband or wife, and the wife to their husband. They are the ones who make the decisions. They are the ones who run the home according to their specifications and mutual decisions. Now, I have so many things here that I probably won't get. There are some parents who are control freaks. There are some parents who just can't let go of their married kids. And all of their marriage, they're a thorn in the side of that couple, even though they mean well. And so I just want to say to all of you tonight, if you're one of those parents who has married children and you have to constantly be interjecting and initiating yourself into their lives, back off and leave it alone, because it will produce resentment either in the life of the husband, if it's the wife over here and her family, or if it's the opposite, it will produce resentment. Here's another thing that you might know. This might sound kind of strange to you. Did you know that husbands are bigger babies after they get married than their wives are? Did you know that? It's a proven fact. Psychologists tell us that a lot of the problem, I saw one of you say, no. Yes, that's true. That husbands sometimes have greater problems leaving mom and transferring allegiance over to wife than wife does leaving dad and transferring allegiance over to husband. That's a common observation, by the way, from marriage counselors, not mine. I don't know that I would make that comment or make that observation, but it often comes from there. So the if you are one of those individuals, and sometimes it's not just the opposite side of the family. There are actually some parents that will encourage their own children to speak to their own children against the spouse that they've married. I heard a while back about a wife that got disturbed with her husband and she ran back home. And she said, Dad, here I am. Have you got some advice for me? He said, yes, I do. You go right back home. You go right back home. Talk this out. Work this through. Don't be running home here. You married this man. He's a good man. Now, you're going to have problems, so you work this out. And that's good advice. Don't take the side. Lend a loving ear, but don't lend a critical ear. Don't speak against your son-in-law or your daughter-in-law because it puts your children in a very precarious place. And I would say for the same of you that are married, don't call up mom or dad and be critical of your husband. It just is not the thing to do, and it creates problems. Now, here, let's go on to this next one here. One girl said, my mother owns... When we talk about controlling our married children by manipulation and by guilt, one woman said, you know, my mother owns the Midwest distributorship of guilt. And some parents do that. They control by guilt or shame. You don't love us anymore. You don't listen to us anymore. And it's a sad thing when parents do that. Now, here's another thing that's really important for a marriage. And you can write this down. I better look in my notes and see where I've got it there. Let's see if I can find it here. No, I've lost it. Here it is. Let's put leave there. And then the next thing now is leave. You not only leave father and mother, but you leave past attachments, past romantic involvements. If you've had previous romantic involvements, you have to bury those. Listen to me now carefully, because you know what? They have discovered, those that do research in these areas of family relationships, because of Facebook, there are marriages that are being destroyed by the hundreds and the thousands across America of men and women getting back in contact with old flames. Remember when you were in high school and you dated that guy or you dated that gal, or when you were in college and you dated that guy or that gal and you just had a wonderful time and then something went wrong and you broke up and then you fell in love with this jerk and you married him. And now after 10, 15, 20, 25 years, things are not going very well. And what happens so often on Facebook today, people get in contact with individuals of previous years that at one time they had a torch for. And out of that, then they got to talking. They get to talking, these individuals, and that kindles, the enemy feeds that, and he fuels that. And before you know it, people are running off to spend their life with somebody that they knew 20, 25, 30, 35 years ago. In fact, one of the pastors that I read a lot in his series for this here, he said he and his wife were out on a back trail one day. And they were walking along hand in hand, he and his wife. And Erwin Lutzer is his name. He's the pastor emeritus of the Moody Bible Church. And they've been married for a long, long time. And they were walking along, and they met this other couple that were walking along hand in hand. And just mooning and fawning over one another. And they were of older years. And they thought, how wonderful is this? Here, we're not the only couple in love at our age. Here's this other couple. So they stopped to talk to them. And they found out, this older couple said, we're on our honeymoon. We're on our honeymoon. And they said, Pastor Lutzer said, that's wonderful. Tell me, how did you meet? Tell me, how can you, you're up in age like we are. How's your honeymoon? They said, well, you know, neither one of us were in very fulfilled marriages. Neither one of us had very much going in our relationship. Me with my husband and he with his wife. And then we got in touch on Facebook through a college reunion. And we found out that we truly loved one another back then, and that we made a mistake when we married our previous spouses, and so we divorced them, and here we are now on our honeymoon. I can tell you, friends, there's going to be some disappointed people in that relationship before they go very far. Once the new wears off, there's going to be some disappointed people. Facebook, if every single person that's married has to leave past attachments of former relationships, and if you don't think that you're susceptible, given the right circumstances, under the right conditions, that previous relationships, if you're not careful and prayerful, if they cannot be fanned into a flame where the devil can dilute and distract and destroy your marriage, you're, again, very, very naive. Do not fool around with past attachments in your life. I don't care if you've been married 2 years or 25 years or 40 years. In fact, the longer you're married, if you are somewhat disenchanted in your relationship, you may be even more susceptible to that than somebody in their newer relationship. So you have to leave father and mother and cleave to one another, and you have to denounce and to leave behind all past attachments. And then you have to cleave. That's number two. Cleave. Cleave to your wife. I'm thinking of something like Velcro at this point. Cleave to your wife. It says there, in all the world, I'm honoring and committed to you. Think of all the problems that would be taken care of if we simply left and cleft. I didn't know if there was a word like that, but I put it in there. But then I got to thinking as I was writing this, yeah, he hideth my soul in the cleft of the rock. So there is a word like that. And I looked it up then to just see that I wasn't making it up. And it means a division or a point of separation. In other words, we leave and we cleave. And this cleaving part means that through Dan Allender has got some wonderful thoughts. He said, trust is built on many acts of faithfulness. No marriage can ever be happy, he said, without trust. It is central to the marriage. In fact, he goes on, a marriage without trust is an empty well. It promises satisfaction, but it never delivers. You must be able to safely trust in your mate, and once that trust is lost, it has to be regained or you're headed for dark days ahead. I counseled with a husband one time in another community years and years ago that he was a very jealous person. Some people take pride and say, I'm jealous. I'm so jealous of my husband. I'm jealous of my wife. And they count that as a virtue. Don't ever count jealousy as a virtue. It's actually a sign of insecurity. It's actually a sign that of lack of trust. If you're one of these people that says that if you catch your husband or your wife, and I shouldn't say catch, but if you see them talking, there are some people so small-minded, I guess the word is, that if they see their husband or wife talking to someone of the opposite sex, immediately their countenance changes and they're all upset. What's going on there? What did he say to you? What did you say to him? I had a man one time that came in and he said, I don't trust my wife any farther than I can spit. He said, when I go to work in the morning, I go out and I read the odometer on the car. And when I come home at night, I read the odometer on the car. And if there's 5 miles in there, I want to know where those 5 miles, how came. It's only 2.25 down to the grocery store and back because I fend that out. Now, what was those other 2.5 miles? What were you doing in those 2.5 miles? He said, what do you think of that? I said, not much. Not much. You see, reading the odometer meter on your car is only an indication of the poor situation your relationship is in. And if you think, if you have to go out and read the odometer to see where your wife went during the day, you're mistaken if you think that she has to use that car to go somewhere to be unfaithful to you. you need help and your wife needs help. So I say this kindly. If you're one of these people that's just insanely jealous, that is not a virtue. That is not a virtue. That is the enemy trying to capitalize on a fearful spirit. That's the enemy trying to just get you to be suspicious and to be just play detective in every situation where you see your spouse might be. And I hope that if you are, as a spouse, that you are one of those individuals that you can trust your spouse anywhere. That you can just know that you don't have to sit there and drum on the deal and wonder what's he doing now, what she's doing now. That you have a mutual confidence and a mutual trust in that person. So that word cleave there. I had a couple where he went off to the service, and he was a fighter pilot, by the way. Very gifted young man. He was killed. He crashed his plane. That's a long story. But he would write home to his wife, and he would say, "Sweetheart, you'll never believe what goes on here. These guys are not faithful to their wives. They go out, they drink. They, when they're drunk, they take other women home. They even bring them back here to the barracks." And he said, I just don't know how they can live that way. And I remember she brought his letter in to me. She was so proud of him. She said, "This is the man I married. This is the man I married. He's every bit as much of a man physically as those men are that are cheating on their wives, but he's got integrity." And I'll never forget that. And then just a few weeks later, he was killed. I married that couple, and I buried him. Sad thing, but a committed Christian man who was filled with integrity. And when he stood at the marriage altar and took his vows, he meant what he said. And he wasn't going to betray those, though he was far away from home. And how could his wife ever know? Now, I want to say one other word here, number three, about covenant. Covenant. And that is this. Nowadays, there are about as many couples living together as there are married. Did you know that? That there's just about as many couples living together as there are married. You might not know it, but the average age at which a young man is married nowadays is 29.5. He's 29.5. For the women, it's 27.5. The average age in which people are postponing or prolonging the time before they get married. And for young women, the average age is 27 before they get married. And for men, it's 29. And one of the things that in this, quote, enlightened day and age in which we live, where every man's his own boss and he's going to be a law to himself, and every woman feels the same way. It's her body. She's going to do with it what she wants, no matter what God says. But I've even had this come up lots of times in counseling. I don't know if we'll get married or not. After all, what's a piece of paper? What's a piece of paper? That's all it is, just a piece of paper. And, you know, that argument is such a frail argument. You know, if you've ever bought a house, you don't just go over, you know, it says, you don't just go over and shake hands with a guy and say, hey, what do you want for your house? And let's just say he says, "I want $250,000. And you say, "Well, that sounds reasonable. Let's just shake on that. I'll pay you X amount of dollars a month, and that's a deal." "Deal?" "No." "Oh, no. What's a piece of paper?" You hire an attorney. They've got an attorney. You've got an attorney. You spend an hour and a half signing papers. You have no idea what they mean. But the attorney says, "Yes, you need to sign right here," and you sign there, and you sign there. You know, what's a piece of paper? You buy an automobile. You don't go down here to any one of these dealerships, pick out a car, and say, "What do you want for this car?" And let's just say he says $23,000. You say, "Okay, that sounds like a deal. I'll pay you $450 a month until it's paid for." "Okay? Okay, good. See you. Got the keys?" He would say, "No, just a minute. What? That's not how things work. We have to have some legal things here. You have to make a commitment. You have to sign your name on there." And so whenever I hear somebody say, "Well, you know, it's just a piece of paper," that's not really true. That's not really true. If you have purchased a house, now we're talking about covenant and commitment. Say you went and purchased a house. My son has told me some different incidents. He's a realtor in Denver. And he's told me some different things that people, after they buy a house, some of the things they come up with. After you buy a house, it's sometimes people will say to the person they bought the house from, I didn't know that we were right in line with the airport out there. I guess I must have been tone deaf that day that we were here. I didn't know these planes were going to go 300 feet above our house day and night. Where were they the day we were here and looked at this house? Well, that day they might have been coming in from the north and south, you see. But if you lived in east and west, and there you are. And then to top it off, and they'll also say, another thing I found out, there's mice in the attic. And I didn't know that when I signed the thing here. And then to top it really off, you drive down the street to that other house that you, when you drove by, you always thought, that's a cute little house, but it was never available. But now there's a for sale sign in front of it. And you think, oh, of all the rotten luck. Yeah, now that thing's for sale. Do you see the application to that even in relationships? Well, the thing of it is, please be advised that, and you think to yourself, I should have waited and bought that house that was for sale down there. But what you didn't know is that there's mold in the basement of that house down there. What you didn't know is that there's radon in that house down there. And that all has to be negated and cared for. But it sure looks good from the outside. Do you see the applications to that in personal relationship? I told you this story several years ago, so I'm going to share it again. Most of us can't remember what we had for breakfast, let alone the story from years ago anyhow. But it's about a man who was walking through a psych ward. And he got to the first room, and there was a man in there banging his head against a padded wall. Just boom, boom, boom. And he said to the guy that was taking him through there, what's his problem? And the monitor said, well, he was madly in love with Matilda. And Matilda jilted him and left him at the altar for another guy. And he just couldn't handle it. He never did get over it. So all day long he just bangs his head against the wall down there saying, Matilda, how could you do it? Matilda, how could you do it? When they got to the end of the hall, he noticed there was another man banging his head on the padded cell down there. And he said, he was saying, Matilda, how could you do it? Matilda, how could you do it? And he said, what's his problem? And he said, that's the guy that married Matilda. You see, the grass, it was like Irma Bombeck said this. And she said, the only place that the grass is ever greener is over the neighbor's septic tank. So if you think about that, there's a lot of truth in that aspect of us always thinking, coulda, woulda, shoulda, I would have been better off, things would have been better off, he would have never treated me like this, she never would have done this, and Matilda, how could you do it? Matilda, how could you do it? That's what happens when we don't keep our covenant and our commitment in love. Well, let me just give you these last three things and you can fill them in. How is it possible to have a better marriage? Well, the first key is you have to have a better heart. I'm thoroughly convinced of this as a pastor, that most marriage problems relate to sin in our heart. If I'm having a problem with my wife, I would venture to say that 90% of the time it's a problem with sin in my heart. My heart, not hers. My heart. Because then I see I lose my love, I lose my kindness, I lose my tenderness, I begin to make excuses as to why she's not doing what she should, she's not keeping her into the bargain, and I transfer my frustration with my lack of spiritual commitment to blame on my spouse. And I'm here to tell you tonight in love, dear friends, that I'm thoroughly convinced that as Pastor was sharing with us this morning, That if you're having a problem in your marriage, I don't care whether you've been married 5 years, 15 years, or 55 years, as Dory and I have. If you're having a problem in your marriage, you probably need a spiritual revival in your own heart. You are the one that needs the new heart. You are the one that needs also a honest heart. That's two. Being honest. One guy was, they were in for a council for a marriage, and the pastor said to them, he said to the man, if your wife were in a tragic accident on your honeymoon and was a quadriplegic for the rest of your life, her life, could you handle it? The man thought about that a moment, and he got up and he said, you know what? I'm not sure I'm married. I'm ready for marriage yet. I don't know if my commitment goes that far. So it's possible to have a new heart and still not have an honest heart. There are people who have been married for 25 or 30 years and they've never addressed all the issues that divide them. Though they methodically live together in the same house, they may connect in many ways occasionally, but they already know we don't talk about the relatives, we don't talk about his dad, we don't talk about my mom, we don't talk about her parents and the bad influence, we just don't go there, we don't talk about our intimacy, we don't talk about this, we just don't go there. It just produces all kinds of problems. And I'll tell you what, if that's the situation, we need a renewed heart in ourselves and we need an honest heart. And then lastly, we need a forgiving heart. We need a forgiving heart. Again, going back to Erwin Lutzer, he tells the story about a time when he and his wife Rebecca were at the airport in Minneapolis. I quote him now. He said, Rebecca was getting me a sandwich, as she lovingly always does. She's always looking out for my needs. I wish I looked out for hers as well as she does for mine. And, you know, I have to say that of myself. If I was half as thoughtful of my wife as she is of me, it would be a wonderful thing. I don't think I am. And then there was a woman just across the way, the Turnamon. She said, I notice you two are getting along. You seem to get along so well. And I'm going to get married soon. What advice do you have for me? And, you know, he says, I'm looking around and thinking, I'm Dr. Erwin Lutzer. I'm a pastor. I can answer that question. And he said, before I could even say anything, my wife burst in and she said, you have to have the ability to forgive. And he said, I looked at her and said, that's right. She said it. Well, he said, I said, well, thank you, Rebecca. I appreciate you so much. Considering who you live with, yeah, the ability to forgive is a big one. Friends, if you're not quick to ask forgiveness, you need to be. Probably most of the time when I officiate a wedding, I always say that there are 12 magical words that I give to every couple. And I tell them at the altar, and believe it or not, some of them even write back to me years later and say, we've never forgotten those because we wrote them down afterwards. There are four magic phrases in couplets of three. And I'd encourage you to write these down tonight and write them on the back of your eyelids and try it out. See if it works or not. Here they are, 12 words in couplets of three times four. I am sorry. I am sorry, sweetheart. Just say I'm sorry. And then here's the second one. I was wrong. I've had people tell me I've been married to my spouse for X amount of years. I've never heard him. I've never heard her admit that she or he was wrong. I'm sorry. I was wrong. Here's a big one. Please forgive me. I'm sorry. I was wrong. Please forgive me. I love you. That's the last one. I'm sorry. I was wrong. You were partly wrong too. No. I was wrong. Take the full responsibility. Be man enough, be woman enough to take the full responsibility. Please forgive me. I love you. Let's pray.